Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We are nearly at the end of 2 Samuel 17, this long narrative and drama concerning David and his son Absalom. David is in flight. Ahithophel, his traitorous former counselor who had a grievance against David, had given Absalom very good advice. But Hushai, David's loyal counselor who was there really as a pretended loyal counselor to Absalom, is enabled by God to give Absalom advice that neutralizes that of Ahithophel, who was considered something like an oracle of God in his day as a counselor. All of this is intended to illustrate how God's purposes will not be thwarted. Somebody else may seem to have all the right cards. They may seem to have the drop on us. They may seem to have everything on their side. But as a matter of fact, when God aims to protect his people, God will do it. And when he aims to fulfill his promises, he will fulfill them on time and on the dime. And his purpose will not be thwarted, no matter how formidable our enemies may be. The scene now shifts in verse 23. Now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, arose, and went to his home, to his city, and he set his house in order, and he strangled himself. And thus he died and was buried in the grave of his father. Then it shifts back to David. David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan, he and all of his men of Israel with him. Absalom set over his army Amasa in the place of Joab, who was with David. Now Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Jethro the Israelite, who went into Abigail, the daughter of Naash, the sister of Jeriah, Joab's mother. So all these people are related. And Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. David had come to Mahanaim, and there Shobah, the son of Joash, from Rabbah, the sons of Ammon, and Maker, the sons of Amiel of Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogalim, they brought supplies, which are cataloged here for the record. Ahithophel was prescient in his wisdom. He was one of those wise persons who could see causes and effects and rather accurately project the outcomes of human actions. He knew he had given exactly the right advice to Absalom. He also knew that Hushai's counsel, plausible as it was to Absalom, was, if followed, going to be the undoing of Absalom. And all those, like himself, who had been complicit in his treachery were going to pay the price. The jig was up, and he saw that before anyone else. With Ahithophel, it was either let David come back and execute him for his part in the rebellion, or just end his own life. It was inevitable. So that's the course that Ahithophel took. It just goes to show, folks, how a great and distinguished career, in this case in royal service, was ended in infamy. And why? Well, because of a root of bitterness. Because of a desire for revenge and David's sin. Bitterness is a poison in the soul. It can destroy us, and it can destroy people around us. Ahithophel chose to deal with his anger his own way. Big mistake. He chose to exact his own revenge on David for the Bathsheba affair, for he was affected as a relative. He should have just let God deal with it. And in the end, because he didn't, it cost him his honor as well as his life. Sad thing. But unfortunately, many people, many moderns, sometimes Christian people, choose to do the same thing. And at best, they complicate their lives, and at worst, they destroy them. I'm sure many of my listeners right this minute are dealing with a lot of unresolved bitterness and anger for harm that others have done to you. Maybe that harm is real, maybe it's imagined. But my friends, my advice is, let it go. Let God deal with it. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Ahithophel would have been light years ahead, just to remember that. Don't force the Lord by your own godless actions and retaliation for real or imagined injury to put you in the crosshairs of his discipline. Just remember Ahithophel and take warning. By the way, on a side note here, let me mention when I was last in Israel, an Israeli God, an Oxford-educated Ph.D., told our group when we were visiting Masada, where the Jewish historian Josephus said that the defenders of the fortress all committed suicide rather than surrender to the Romans. She said that his account of events, though Josephus was a contemporary of the events, she said, with modern arrogance, though I liked her very much, Josephus was in error because, hey, it was verboten for Jews to commit suicide. Well, folks, she was just flat out wrong. And this is one of those instances where a Jewish aristocrat took his own life. Judas was another, and there are other examples. I mention this because if you're over there and you're part of a tour, just let that be a warning that you can't believe everything that these experts on the Holy Land tell you. Much of it is good and much of it is right, but none of it is inspired. Well, in verse 24, the narrative scene shifts back to David. On the other side of the Jordan, on Hushai's advice, David came to Mahanaim, the last residence of the house of Saul under Ishbosheth. Absalom is giving chase, and with all of his forces, Absalom crosses the Jordan. His military chief of staff is a man named Amasa, by whose pedigree and DNA we know to be the cousin of the venerable Joab and a warrior to the bone. It's a curious question. Why, then, would Amasa join up with Absalom? Now, what I'm about to say is not a revealed fact, but an educated guess. My guess is that Amasa was probably carried away by wounded pride. Pride that David gave more attention to Joab and his other relatives than Amasa. And Amasa just wanted a chance to show David his mistake. It's all a great reminder, if I'm right, that such pettiness distorts our characters. And it can, if we allow it to run long and hard, lead to very bad decisions that can bring us, as in his case, eventually to ruin. In verse 26, before the actual engagement of the two opposing forces, we're told that Absalom sets up his camp in the land of Gilead on the east side of the Jordan to prepare for hostile action. In verses 27 and 29, we see that in David's camp in Mahanaim, the people are famished, they're fatigued, and they're ripe for destruction. You see how good Ahithophel's advice was in retrospect. But now God makes timely provision for them through people still loyal to David and to God's man. One of them was even a wealthy Ammonite, Shobi, the son of Nahash of Rabbah. He was a member of the Ammonite royal family, apparently. Another was named Machir. He was the son of Amiel from Lodabar, the man who had looked after Mephibosheth, the lame son of Saul, until David took on that responsibility in behalf of Jonathan. And the other was a noble, elderly gentleman, Barzillai, the Gileadite. These three brought a trainload of every kind of provision to succor David's soldiers and encourage and revive their strength for the coming contest with Absalom. You know, one can only imagine how this unexpected supply train revived their morale and fighting spirit for the showdown with Absalom. You know, I always say, and many of my people never forget it, that God seldom saves the bacon until it's crisp. Well, it was crisp, and now God comes with the manna, so to speak. God had made promises to David concerning his house. The Lord was not going to let the treason of Absalom defeat those promises. God is not doing this for David's sake, but God is doing it for the sake of his own name, for his reputation, for his faithfulness. You know, we ourselves are not worthy of God's mercies. But where God's integrity is involved in your issues and in mine, well, you rest assured that one way or another, God will take care of his good name. And that's what he does right here. This brings us now to chapter 18. In this chapter, the decisive battle between David and his treasonous son Absalom is on. And Absalom will die ingloriously on the field of battle. In opposing his father David, what he has really done is set himself against God himself. We can never forget that perspective. So many of the things that we do, friends, it may appear that we're taking on other human beings, but our warfare is not against flesh and blood. It's against spiritual forces in heavenly places, the unseen, the demonic. And sometimes, if we're on the wrong side, we're fighting against God. And that's a losing proposition. In the end, God always has the last word. And we see in chapter 18 how it plays out. Then David numbered the people who were with him, setting everybody in military array. He sets over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. David sent the people out, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, "I myself will surely go out with you also." But the people objected. They said, "You should not go out, for we indeed, if we flee, they'll not care about us. Even if the half of us die, they will not care about us. But you, in your position, you're worthy of 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you be ready to help us from the city." And the king said to them, "Your wish is my command. I will do whatever you want to do." So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and thousands. And the king charged, this is important in this chapter, he charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, Absalom." And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. David now musters his small but loyal army. But with God, folks, it doesn't matter whether it is an army of many or few or none on his side of the equation. In the end, God wins. Of course, Absalom, godless as he was, didn't know what an unequal contest he faced, because he doesn't know God. He doesn't know until he was dead and went out to face the true and living God. And so it is with all men who are foolish enough to set themselves against God and his servants. David, we see, has three highly trusted generals, and he divides the command of his troops between the three of them. One under Joab, one under Abishai, and one under the command of Ittai the Gittite. A man from the Philistine territory of great military skill and bravery, whose loyalty David had earlier tested when David was making his flight from Jerusalem. Humanly speaking, in any enterprise, military or otherwise, a leader is only as effective as those leaders under him. And one essential quality in a leader is that he must be able to enlist people who are right or qualified for the job, who are motivated and willing to do it. And finally, and very important, loyal to the leader. You miss at any one of those points, and eventually you have a messy situation. David was good at spotting the requisites, but even he at times failed on that score. I've had two major corporate executives tell me over the years that with all of their experience and training in finding the right people for jobs in their companies, they've never found a way to be right more than 60% of the time. One told me that the best personnel he ever knew in the business world got it right only about 80% of the time. If that tells us anything, it tells those of us in leadership who know God that we surely need divine guidance more than anything. Even there, folks, I have found in my experiences that the Lord, for his own reasons, sometimes allows us to draft a ringer. You say, what? Yes, he did that in the case of Judas. The Lord sometimes has some purpose for allowing unfit people to serve in the mix. In the case of Judas, of course, the Lord Jesus himself was not fooled by Judas. We know that from the beginning. The other disciples were fooled. But our Lord knew that his function was in the end to betray him into the hands of sinners when his hour came. For him to die for our sins and to be glorified in the greatest demonstration of divine love that could ever be seen or imagined. So we must remember that. And that enables us to handle even that with a lot more poise and aplomb than we might otherwise. But we must never take ourselves for granted. David had a good nose for the right people, but it was not a perfect nose. And we see that more than once. David proposed, as kings often did in those ancient times, to lead his forces into battle. That was the more normal thing. In this case, his proposal was stoutly rejected by his followers as brave and bold, but tactically a bad idea. They knew that David would be the one targeted by the army of Absalom, not them. They knew that it would not be smart to make it easy for the army of Absalom to gain its prize. Besides, David was getting older. He was not the same warrior he used to be. They knew that too. "You should not go out," they tell him in verse 3, "for if we indeed flee, they won't give a hoot about us," I paraphrase. "Even if half of us die, they won't care about that. Your value to their purpose is 10,000 of us. Therefore, it's better that you be ready to help us from the city." So long as David was alive, his cause was alive. In other words, if Absalom's supporters managed to kill David, it was over. So David was to stay behind in the safety of a walled city with some reserves, and if needed, as a last resort, come to the aid of his troops. Well, to that plan, David acquiesced. He saw the wisdom of it. Though a king who could impose his will, we note this about David. He had ears, as I call it. He was smart enough to listen to his commanders and advisors. Folks, being a leader does not make one's judgment infallible by any stretch. The Proverbs teach, in the multitude of counsel, there is safety. Nor was David one of those insecure leaders who had to show that he was in charge lest he lose face. I've seen too many of those guys. In my lifetime, I've known all sorts of leaders. Out of all those, I remember one whom, on a personal basis, I liked very much. He had great leadership qualities in some respects, as well as fine character qualities. But he had what I've always called the evil Knievel fault. You remember years and years ago when that daredevil attempted to bridge the Snake River Canyon on a motorcycle? Well, he came just a few feet short of greatness. He was only saved from death by netting. Well, this fellow that I'm talking about, not Evil Knievel, had what I call the Evil Knievel fault. He fell short of greatness, and he ultimately doomed his leadership because of this one fault. For all of his good qualities, he absolutely had no ears. As good as he was in so many ways, admirable ways, no underling could tell him anything, ever, that I know of, ever, even when their better wisdom should have been obvious. I never recall a time when anyone changed his mind about a thing. And ultimately, unlike David, that was his executive undoing. What a shame, what a wasted talent, all for the lack of ears. Ears the great King David had. The thing about it is that if a leader does not have ears for other men, there's a stronger chance that his ears for the voice of the Spirit are likely deficient also. So, in deference to their collective wisdom, we read that the king stood beside the gate of the city, Mahanaim, and all the people went out by hundreds and thousands, that is, an orderly military array and organized units, but not without one final explicit royal order for his three generals. The king charged all three, saying, "Deal gently, for my sake, with the young man Absalom." All the people heard when the king charged the commanders concerning Absalom, so this was no secret communique. As this looming battle takes shape, the heart of the father, David, is conflicted with the heart of the king and the supreme commander. A residual sense of guilt for all this mess continues to haunt David. He feels still some responsibility for the way things have gone so badly with his family, and what tipped Absalom's wagon to get to this awful point in the life of the nation. Guilt, real guilt, though forgiven by God, folks, it has this way of haunting us as we see the consequences of our actions, and has a way of sometimes distorting us in our judgment. The first thing we need to do in dealing with guilt is to confess our sin. David did that, fully and frankly. Then, the second thing is to keep asking the Lord to help us process and manage that guilt, in such a way that past mistakes, past sins, are not the fertile mother of future ones. We will see an example of this in the next chapter, where David's tortured soul might have cost him dearly. Now the conflict begins, but the narrator in his purpose is not interested by any means in a blow-by-blow account. The narrator's interest is in telling us where the battle was joined, who won, and what happened to Absalom and its effect on David. The site of the battle, the field of Ephraim, is disputed, most favoring a densely wooded locale on the east side of Jordan, which speculation goes was for some reason named after Ephraim. Others argue for a forested area on the west side of the Jordan in the territory of Ephraim proper. Plausible cases can be made either way, but I'll tell you, the world doesn't hang on determining which view is correct. The important thing, so far as the outcome of the fighting is concerned, is that David chose to give battle on ground very favorable to the kind of fight he wanted to wage. He did not want to go up against vastly superior numbers, that's Absalom's army, in an open plain. He desired to give battle in terrain that would break up units, allow for what today we call guerrilla-like tactics, and which might lend itself to the confusion of war. In dividing up his forces into three units under three generals, David's strategy was to play small ball, as it were, to keep away from the threat of the big home run, wear them down, confuse them, let the forest themselves, unfamiliar to Absalom's troops apparently, take their toll. It's a brilliant strategy. Well, we learn from verse 8 that the forest devoured more that day than the sword. The headline is that the people of Israel, Absalom's troops, were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter that day was great, 20,000 men. The rout was on, and it was from the Lord, with whom Absalom in the final analysis was at war. Not smart. When the U.S. and its allies invaded Iraq, it was repeatedly emphasized by our political leaders that we were not aiming to destroy the Iraqi people, but the intent was to bring down the monster who was their evil leader, Saddam Hussein. A similar perspective dominates this narrative. The mission is not to destroy the followers of Absalom, though many were slaughtered, but to capture and detain their leader, the rebellious Absalom. Hence, what happens to Absalom is the focus of the rest of the narrative in chapter 18. In the course of the fighting in the dense forest of Ephraim, Absalom happened to meet in hostile action the servants of David. Now, in those days, the conveyance of choice was not a big white charger, like Alexander the Great had, but a mule. Absalom suddenly appears riding on his mule, perhaps from fright or who knows what reason. The mule darted under the branches of a great oak tree, we're told. For some reason, maybe because the branches were too thick and he had no room to maneuver and avoid them, whatever, the text says his head caught fast in the oak. It got stuck, I guess, in the forks of the branches, in such a way that Absalom could not extract himself as his mule went charging on, riding out from under him. Had it not been such a serious and tragic event, Absalom would have been a laughingstock forever. So he was left hanging between heaven and earth. There's a none too subtle theme here, it has been pointed out. You will recall, perhaps, that according to the Torah, those who were hung on a tree were considered accursed by God, Deuteronomy 21:23. The Spirit of God had that inserted in the law given by Moses, because it was a type of Christ who took our sin curse upon himself when the Romans suspended him on a cross between heaven and earth as God's sin-bearer became sin for us. But in Absalom's case, Absalom the rebel against God, against his king, against his father, as he hangs there suspended, he's the veritable image of a person accursed by God, accursed hanging from a tree, not dead, however, but alive. This is going to present a great problem. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.